This afternoon, I am going to interview Russell E. Iden from Homeworth, particularly about his association with Taylor Aircraft. This is Wednesday afternoon, July 13, 1977, and we're going back a number of years in Alliance history. I want to start first with the background with Mr. Iden, where he grew up and how he happened to associate with Taylor. Let's start first with where you were born, where you grew up. Just a minute, your nickname, or you go by Duke.
I go by Duke. I use Duke in the aviation industry.
Okay. And we'll get to that, how you used that. But where did you grow up, Duke?
I was raised in Minerva, about 12 miles to the south of here.
Right.
And from a very early age, I had a desire to fly. And when I was 16, I got my student permit.
How did you get a permit in those days?
Well, I had to go to Akron and take a physical in about all of the mountain schools. And there was one airplane in Minerva, and I propped the airplane for the man, and I cranked it for him, did anything I could do to get a ride or be around an airplane. And I got 45 minutes of instructions, and at that time it was $25 an hour. $25 an hour was easy to come by for a young man in a small town in Depression days.
Now, what kind of a plane? Was this a biplane?
Yes, it was a biplane. It was a Waco, a Model 10 Waco, built down Troy, Ohio. It had a Siemens Holsky engine on it.
Spell that, the name, that engine. Or, do you know?
I can't let the... It was a German-built engine, and the way a lot of them got here, Goodyear, used them on their blimps. That's how this might have been surplus engine. The Waco 10 was normally powered with an LX5, 90 horsepower. This was a 7-cylinder radio engine, developed around 120 horsepower. It was really pretty
good. Yes. For that day, that would be.
It was a nice airplane. I felt that then there was no restrictions on you had to have so many hours before you could solo, so I felt that I was ready to solo, and I don't think the owner of the airplane, well, it was customary, that when you soloed through somebody else's airplane, you put up a bond. This airplane cost $3,000, and he said, yes, he said, you can fly it, but I have to have a bond of $3,000, and $3,000 costs more than a home, and this was out of question, so I thought, airplane, the Rearman Junior, with a 3-cylinder, 45 horsepower engine.
Now, what was the name of that?
Rearman Junior.
How did you spell it?
R-E-A-R-W-I-N.
Okay.
It was built in Kansas City, and I bought it used off of a man in Indianapolis. They flew it in, and it cost me $500. And I had never soloed an airplane at that time. And I flew it, not necessarily by accident. I told a young man, I said, a friend of mine, Sherman Studer, he took me down, he wanted to see the airplane. So we went down, I said, I'm going to, and we started it up. And I'd never landed one by myself. And I said, now I'm going to go up on the runway here, and I'm going to taxi up and down. I said, now if I do take off, this was in a field that was only about 1,100 feet long, the south of Minerva. And there was a brickyard at one end and a barn at the other end. I said, I won't try to land here. I will land out in the Uncover's Field, we called it. This is where the barnstormers always landed, with the old Curtis Jennings.
Now, whereabouts in Minerva would that
be? That's where the TRW.
All right.
That's where the
yes.
TRW plant is now. So I think when I taxied up there, I had every intention of flying. I did. I took off. And I told him, I said, I'll land out at the open of the field, and you be there in case something happens.
Okay, now you're
and
taking off.
I took off and flew out, and I landed. Uneventfully, and from then on, in those days, if you got an airplane up and got it down, you were then a pilot.
Can you remember your sensation, your feeling, whenever you took off and landed at that time?
Well, I had a great love to fly,
mm-hmm.
no question about that. And I think that there isn't an intelligent pilot living today that doesn't have some apprehension about takeoff. This is possibly, a lot of people think landing an airplane is possibly the most difficult. I think the most hazardous part of flight is takeoff, because at a certain time, if the engine quits, there isn't anything you can do to keep going straight ahead. And whatever straight ahead, you've got to accept. And this can be either good or bad.
Right.
But then I needed a wheel for my airplane. For some reason, I don't recall. It was a fragile craft. There's no question about that.
Oh, this was a biplane also.
Oh, this was a monoplane.
This is a monoplane.
This is a two-place monoplane, yes. And to get the wheel, I had to go up to Sharon, Pennsylvania. Well, I knew of the Taylor Airplane Company that built what they called the Cub at Bradford, Pennsylvania. But I didn't know of the financial inner workings of a plane. I was too young and too far removed from it. It was just another airplane factory to me. I didn't know C.G. Taylor or Bill Piper. But I went to Sharon to get the wheel that I needed from a man that was making wheels up there, a man by the name of Shin, which is now the Goodyear tire and brake division for their aircraft.
Oh.
They bought out his operation mm-hmm. and proceeded to expand on it. And it is now a established product in American production. Mm-hmm. In the hangar, he had a little room adjacent to the hangar there, set one of the most beautiful little airplanes that I've saw. And it was the first aircraft he ever built.
Oh.
Mr. Taylor had severed his relationships with the Taylor Airplane Company in Bradford. And Mr. Piper took over the operation there through financial arrangements. And Mr. Taylor built this. They had been building what we called a tandem airplane, one man sitting in back of the other. This airplane was the first really light side-by-side, where you sit side-by-side. There was, Monocoup was building a small side-to-side airplane, but it wasn't really considered a light plane. Mm-hmm. It was a professional pilot's airplane. I'd flown one, and it was nothing for a student to fly. But this was a very beautiful little, lot of wonderful engineering in it, and I recognized the great potential for it,
mm-hmm.
Even with my limited experience in aviation. And, of course, just looking at it, of course, I said, what is it? This is one of a kind, I've never seen anything. And somebody there in the hangar said, it's a Taylor craft. It was painted gunmetal gray, as I remember, with a red stripe on it. And the next thing I knew, I heard that Mr. Taylor had procured the old Argo factory here in Lyons and was starting to produce the airplane. I went and applied for a job as a welder. I had been taking welding in night school at the McKinley High School in Canton, but I was welding heavy materials there, and this was light welding. And I failed the test.
Huh.
And but I didn't give up. I went back and applied for anything I could do. And I was hired. That was in March 1937, when I was 35th employee.
Now, what had you been doing up? You were going to McKinley, welding, taking welding. What had you been doing up to that time?
As a living?
Yes.
I was in school.
I see.
And working. I worked in a bakery while I was in school.
I see.
What?
Just to get back before you get your association with the Taylor craft there. How did your parents look upon your flying
they
ambition?
They never give me any encouragement or any opposition. I can remember people two men brought the airplane in that I bought. They could fly an airplane for $500 investment, and fly the other man's airplane for a $3,000 investment, so they had $2,500. And I know it was on a Sunday, and of course my folks were church-going people. And after church, my mother and dad drove down to the airport. He said, "Well, what do you think of it, Luke?" And I said, "Well, it doesn't look too bad for $500. I thought about buying a Jenny." This was getting the latter days of the Jenny. There were still some new ones available.
Mm-hmm.
I could have bought a Jenny for about $350. You know, it's 5-engine one, but they were difficult to keep flying.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big, clumsy airplane. And he said, "Why do you want it?" And I said, "Yes, I think I do." And, of course, I had to have some financial help from Dad.
Sure.
That's what he was there for. And, with his blessing, mm-hmm. here. He never rode with me.
Is that right?
I never got.
Huh.
My mother never rode with me.
Oh, that's interesting.
But they never rode. I think I no doubt give them many hours of anxiety.
That's fact, yeah.
But they were quite cooperative.
Now, you said you went to the airport. Was that at the Unkerfer?
No, field? There was a little, this neighbor, Everett Walker, Bonnie Walker, Huey Robbins, the old pioneers in aviation. He had a field up in Stowe, Ohio. He sold Walker airplanes, which were made in Troy, Ohio. They called it the Farmer's Airplane Plant. And they built a good airplane. They were really early pioneers. He bought this Waco 10 and built a hangar. And when I got my airport, I had to build a little addition on the hangar. You couldn't get both of them into one hangar.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall that evening, I think Everett Walker flew the airplane over the camp. And he tried to put it in the hangar the Sunday evening, the Sunday I bought it. But it wouldn't go in, so he took it over to McKinley Airport. The old
mm-hmm.
field there where Lee Sherrick really started. And I hangered it over there, and the next Saturday I went over, and Earl Cale, a good friend of mine who operated, who was a founder of the McKinley Air Transport Company that Kenny Little now owns and operates off of Catnackle Airport.
Oh, now, is that K-A-I-L, Cale?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. He was killed burying a Hudson bomber across to England. He was killed on the north coast of Africa before he started the war. But I had the airplane in the hangar, in Harry Rankin's hangar, and it wouldn't start. I went over to get it to fly back down home. I'd never flown. This is still before I went over to fly solo. And I couldn't get it started, so I dug it down to his hangar to borrow some tools, pull the plugs out, clean the plugs and so forth. And he came out of the office and said, "Duke, what are you doing?" I said, "Trying to get my airplane started." He said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to fly down home." He said, "You can't fly." I said, "Well, just watch me." He said, "Well, you're not going to fly off my feet." So I said, "Well, okay, what are we going to do? What are we going to do here?" I said, "I'm going to get the airplane down home." He said, "Well," I said, "you fly it down and I'll bring you back." But I didn't. Over the bus, left the car at home. Well, he said, "I'll phone for everything else." My nurse, I said, "I'll give you your supper and bring you back." He said, "I'll phone for everything else and I will fly for that." So we flew it down to Monroe. That's, I staked it down so I'd have it there.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was, that was a Saturday night, and Sunday, I made my first solo flight.
Yeah.
I went about 45% instruction. So I wouldn't recommend any better
flight.
But I started back when I was a child, right in the back seat of an old Durant. And whenever Dad would go up a hill, I would have a hold of the door handle or the window handle. And I would move that forward. I worked on my coordination, and this is the way you throttle the lever.
Mm-hmm.
A lever on the side that opened and closed the throttle of the music. And I would practice with that door handle in the car. And when he'd go around a turn, well, I would, if it was a right turn, I would press on my right foot.
Mm-hmm.
Like a younger motor pedal, you know. And you'd
yes.
go the hill, you pull back on the stick, and I had practice, actually, in my mind. And I think that a man can teach himself to do anything
sure.
he wants to, if he wants to do it bad enough, and he was willing to work at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose you read literature about flying.
Oh, also. Studied everything I could get a hold of, naturally, talked to everybody that I could, and observed. And after I did so, I didn't still didn't know how to fly. I didn't know one aspect of landing where you come in and stall the airplane up and keep bringing the stick back and hold it back all the way. I didn't know this is one way you brought the stick back. But I didn't know how to coordinate it with losing the speed, so I would take my brother, who knew nothing, my younger brother, down, and I'd let him stand along the runway, and as I would come in to land and would bounce down across the field, well, he'd tell me what it looked like. And I was trying to work it out that way. But I got acquainted with a man, Lee Sherrington, at the time. I passed away, and he was in Betty Swinford. And he tested Corsairs during the war. And he was in charge of Goodyear's executive aircraft fleet of airplanes. And he gave me some instructions and straightened me out on that. But I didn't have any trouble from that.
Well, I had interrupted you, and you had been applying at Taylor Craft and went back for the second time.
Yeah, I went back the second time, and I got a job. Mm-hmm. That was 35 cents an hour working in the wing department. And I made wing ribs. And it seemed like Lady Luck just hit on my shoulder. I wasn't there very long until they put an airplane on the square down here in Alliance. They had a tent. And I was selected out of two people in the plant to go down there and represent the company with that airplane. I think it was, I had a new 1937 Chevrolet, and we would collar someone there and talk to them, and they would take them out to the plant. I think I was selected because I had a new car that they could ride it, rather than my ability or knowledge of aircraft.
Now, what were you trying to promote?
Selling stock.
Selling stock, okay,
Trying to get next week's payroll.
Yes.
I had the opportunity to participate in that in selling stock to try to raise finances, mm-hmm. while I had no executive position. I was just strictly an hourly employee and mechanic in the poor one at that, with little knowledge. But I thought that was a wonderful opportunity, though.
Yes.
And then they put an airplane in Russell Shellhorn's garage showroom, which is, I believe it's a building on Art Street across from the, Cassell was in there last, or the garage, I don't know what's in there now.
Mm-hmm.
But they had me go down there and meet the public and tell them about the airplane, which I went from the wing department to the sheet metal department and become a sheet metal mechanic under the direction of a man by the name of Ray Sweeney, who had worked on the China Clippers. That's Glenn L. Martin Company, built down in Baltimore. He was a terrific sheet metal mechanic, wonderful. And my progress in those days, it was a small shop. Anyone that wanted to work hard or tried to do a good job, and there was many there that did that, because there was a lot of pride. Mm-hmm. And we worked on these airplanes, and we saw them go out the back door and become a living, almost a living machine, mm-hmm. and fly. And there was a lot of romance to it, and a lot of pride to work.
That's the kind of assembly line you like to be on.
That's right. It was a great team.
Yes.
Went into experimental. From the sheet metal, I was the sheet metal man for the experimental department. And all this time, we were building the original model, what was known as a Model A with an A Continental 40 horsepower engine, a little four cylinder, about 40 horsepower. Sold for around $1,200, $1,300. And then I was told to go down to the old Buckeye Twist Drill. Buckeye Twist Drill had moved out of their plant and gone to Chicago, which is now the United Co-op fate. I believe it's a fate. And Donald Kennedy, another wonderful mechanic, and still lives there alone. He and I were sent down to that plant, and there they had, we built up an experiment, we knew about it. But the experimental was always kept pretty hush-hush. In general, the employees couldn't get into the experimental part. This was a Model B for 50 horsepower. And we ran the study tests. Don and I handled the weights and so forth, and we loaded the airplane up to test it structurally. A young engineer by the name of Johnny Hootmacher was project engineer, and Lee Ray Carlson, who was later at Lightfield, was the chief engineer. And a man by the name of Halderman was the CAA, or Civil Aeronautics Authority, inspector.
Yes.
We had inspector all the time, and he had been the navigator for Ruth Nichols, tried to fly the Atlantic. And they went down in the freighter, not history as I recall it. But it was wonderful working with meeting these kind of people. And I was born on a farm and then come from a little town in Minerva where there was one airplane. I was having a great time.
Oh, you all that.
We worked so many hours down there, and I rode up with them, about six of us from Minerva, worked together. But they would quit at their regular quitting time, 4:30, 5 o'clock, and we would work maybe until 7 or 8 o'clock, and I would walk to Minerva.
Minerva?
I would walk all the way. Yes, 12, 14 miles. At least walk from down there out south of Alliance.
Yeah.
I wouldn't get a ride in town. I'd walk up Union Avenue and go home, eat my supper, and get a bath, and go to bed. Get up early the next morning and be back at the airplane again. And we made the drop tests and got it approved, which is a basic airframe that they're flying today and building today. So it was a wonderful experience. And then I went I was in experimental, and we would develop a new, likely change the type of doors we use. When we built the B-12 model. And I would work on the development of the experimental, and then I would go into the shop and coordinate its manufacture. I'd teach people in the factory to make this new part. So I did that. And then they had a man that got into a little difficulty that was in charge of exporter airplanes, ferry, and therefore I had been, if I get a chance to fly, I would fly. A man, Wes Raymond, was our distributor in Macon, Georgia. If he couldn't send a pilot up, he'd call me and say, "Duke, I bought an airplane. I have an airplane to come down. Will you bring it down? I'll pay your bus trip back." Well, I would fly his airplane down on the weekend and thumb back. Keep the bus. It was great days, and trucks were running up. There was no difficulty.
Oh, it was a different
age.
Right.
And I don't know, the bus we made in $12, $13. Yeah. That's how I would get my wages.
Well, you mentioned this name, Duke. How did you get that nickname?
I carried out from the time I was, I guess I couldn't say Russell, I called myself Duty.
Oh, I see. And so you got it from early.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, I've always been. My son's real name is Duke.
I see.
And this is a
nightmare.
I don't know if I get him a favor.
No, I remember the other day, I think I was talking with Bill Morgan or someone, and something about Taylorcraft, and I mentioned you, and he said, "Oh, you mean Duke." He knew you as,
very few people knew me in the aircraft industry as Russell.
Right. Well, I got you sidetracked again there. You were in the export talking about this.
Well, I got a chance. Fairchild Aviation Corporation in New York built Fairchild Canada. There's two Fairchild companies. One in Hagerstown, Maryland built Fairchild Airplane, and then Fairchild. Whether they have inner financial lockings, I can't say.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this was 30 years ago.
Yes.
But they had money in this Taylor Craft company here in Lyons, and they had the export rights to the airplane. And I got a chance to work with them. Well, I was here in this plant with my friends, but I had charge of all the aircraft that went into delivering the aircraft. It went into Mexico, Central America, down to the Panama Canal Zone, and into Cuba. Anything south of there, any further away than that, we test flew the airplane and then dismantled it and crated it in a big box and shipped it up to New York, dumped it up there, and then put on a boat down to where it comes up. Mm-hmm. And we always heard that these people down in South America made homes out of these boxes that we shipped airplanes in.
Yeah.
But, so I delivered the, in 1941, I delivered the first aircraft that went to Cuba. I flew across 90 miles of open, with no radio, and really no navigation equipment except the compass. And missed the van about 3 miles or so. I flown it from here to New York, picked up a young man whose father was a Cuban counselor in New York, and he could be with a well-versed man, he speaks sign languages. I had to check out, I didn't have to teach a man, but I had to check him out in Cuba to fly this airplane. He had flown for the loyalists, he was a fighter pilot, loyalists in Spain.
In Spain. Mm-hmm.
And when Franco won the fray, he got the last load of Spanish loyalist officials off the Madrid airport. There was two transports standing by at night to evacuate. So Franco would like to have got a hold of those fellows. And the one ship hit a gas truck and exploded and were all killed. And he got his load out. And of course, he had to find a new home and he's back to Cuba. The man that bought the airplane was the president of the Sugarcane Growers Association, but he couldn't fly. And so he employed this Spanish pilot who had been flying a fighter plane, but never flown a small, like this was a 65 horsepower V-12.
Mm-hmm.
And I took Tom Palmer, or Estrada Palmera, with his real name, we called him Tom, down, I think he went up to Roosevelt Field in New York, and he flew down the coast, and 2 days of making our papers in Miami, and I was real, I don't know how to say it, but I had to change the date. I had to make out the same papers that a man was taking a freighter across. I could have married someone in the middle of the if we could have had room to get him in the airplane. I had this authority, but flew across, and after I got to Havana, they warned me not to land any place but land to the Morris Field, and I had no maps of Havana or Cuba. I don't know whether there was any map of Cuba, but I, the Coast Guard, and they warmed up some DBYs to go out and look for me, but it took me 45 minutes after I got over Havana to find the airport. But it was come back on Panama, and I had charged in up until the war. After the war, I spent nearly 2 years instructing for the Air Force, a flight instructor. And then I came back, and I went into the domestic sales department, where we had charge of the sales in Alaska, the United States, Hawaii, Canada. And I had that until I left the company in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Changed hands, and I no longer associated myself with the company. That's about the.
What did you, when you left there, what did you do? Have you done anything connected with aviation since that time?
When I left, Taylorcraft, in the change of management, ownership, and all person, top of chief engineer and vice president of charge production myself, started a company in consulting, making aircraft parts, which was a financial failure. And I liquidated the company after about 3-4 years. Decided to quit flying, because flying meant traveling, and got married at 45, we had one boy, and I wanted to see him grow up.
Yeah.
And I turned down a job with an assessment company as Eastern Regional Sales Manager.
It would, yes.
Cessna was a very up-and-coming company and has done very well. Assistant sales manager following the Derby Fry, John Drew, flew in from Wichita and talked to him. But I said, no, I said, there's people that makes a living sense. So I spent 18 years in the contracting business.
Well, have you done any flying in that time?
Not to speak of, nothing professional. No, not as a professional pilot. I have flown some, but I've got a chance to fly this new Omni navigation system, and it just makes flying and getting from one point.
Seven, eight, nine.
Well, that's going back to 1937.
All right, now I'd ask Mr. Iden the question here about working at the plant, and he spoke about the morale there and about the pride that workers had. My next-door neighbor is Bill Tanner, who worked in the paint division and still works for Taylorcraft now, years later out here. And let's see, Sidney Hartenstein was in, and of course he goes back a lot farther than you do in history, but one of his experiences was working during the war period for Taylorcraft. You probably were out at that time on that. Well, you said you were the, 35th worker?
I was 35th, number 30, my badge number was
35.
35. Yes.
What did they get up to?
1800 and $1 million a month in Florida. This was during the war, of course, and we built many airplanes for the military. The L-2 spotter plane was a Taylorcraft airplane. We built gliders for training glider invasion pilots. But I think one of the large operations was making tail surfaces for the A-26 attack bomber, which was made by Douglas, prime contractor just with Douglas Aircraft.
Yes.
They made some beautiful tail surfaces.
Yeah.
This is where the largest expansion of the plant. Now, we're going back around 1940, I'm going to guess. Dick DePue and C.G. Taylor were operating the company. Fairchild had put this money in. Financing is always a problem with a new and growing industry, especially where the product is not even established. You don't only sell the product, you have to sell the product. It is,
yes.
You know what I mean?
Right.
You find a man, but you got to sell the public.
Sure.
This costs a lot of money. And Fairchild put this money in, and where there was money invested in industry, rightly so, there was also control.
Right.
And Mr. DePue was set in by the Fairchild Company, who was a wonderful man and an old, old pilot. One of the first to learn to fly in France, and he was a wonderful man to work for and with. And the company prospered. This was through 38. 39, 40, I would say. The new office building was built, the new dope room was built, a new foundation for final assembly was built, And we were the second largest producers of privately owned private airplanes in the world. Piper maintained number one position. But we were number two, and it was a fine airplane. It was faster than the Piper airplane, wouldn't get off the ground quite as, it was quite a shorter run, but it was a much better cruising speed and much, it was a wonderful compromise, a good compromise.
One of my neighbors, Cy Syverson, who works for Universal Co-op, now is a pilot. He's trying to, he currently is building a plane as he gets some time, a light plane, but he tells me there are people who still have original Taylor craft and great pride in those, and some of them, okay, he said they keep them up just almost like the day they came off the line.
This last weekend, we had a reunion, you know.
Yes.
And we had 100 old employees that registered there,
mm-hmm.
and there was some 20-some airplanes that had been flown in by people who had, some of these airplanes are 30 years old. Think of what an automobile.
Right.
And the man that flew in, that got the prize for flying in the first, was 800 miles.
I know.
I talked to a man from southern Arkansas. I talked to a man from Canada. I talked to a man from Tennessee. And I think this is a pretty good product.
That's right.
Now, driving on the highway is one thing, but driving a 30-year-old machine, a 30-year-old machine,
yeah.
and flying at 800 miles without a radio,
yeah. That's certainly right. Well, you know, there were some people. I was in college here, and I was out in 36, so before this happened. But as I would come back, I picked up this, I don't know whether you call it exactly a fever, but a promotion that Alliance was a rubber capital. I mean, Akron was a rubber capital. Detroit was a motor. And they were hoping for Alliance to be an aviation center, an airplane center.
It had the greatest possibility that there was, as far as I'm concerned, in the private field, there was more potential. Just by a quirk of financial maneuvering is all the killer.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Because Cessna is possibly one of the best and largest established manufacturers of private airplanes in the class that we were in today, and they actually copied their airplane from what we had in experimental stages in 1945. We had an all-metal fuselage. It wasn't the first all-metal light airplane, fuselage, it was Ruskin made the first, but he had a wing on it that wasn't safe for an amateur pilot to fly. It was fast, but we had an airplane that had everything combined, metal fuselage, and we had come, and Cessna didn't start out with a metal wing. Cessna 140 has a fabric wing. And we were leading the way. And just by a quirk of financial maneuvering, it was all lost.
Well, that's what you read in history so often, isn't
that's
it? Just
right.
one of those little...
Just one of those little things.
Yes.
This could have gone the other way just as well.
Right.
And this could have been very well. I don't know. I give Bill Piper, now dead. Bill Piper was an excellent businessman. And he pyramided, was originally Taylor Aviation, Taylor Airplane Company. It was founded by C.G. Taylor. But Bill Piper did a wonderful job. I don't know how their production today rates with Cessna, but I would say that Cessna, in some ways, outstripped or went ahead a little, of Piper. And this would all depend on who company
you were. Yeah, right. Now, you said when you came up here, you went to the old Argo, or Taylor craft came in. There had been a couple other attempts to make airplanes in Alliance, hadn't there?
The Argo airplane was built here, and this was really before my time.
I see.
I knew about it. But some of the machinery was still there. I've seen one or two of the airplanes that were a small, light biplane with a, I think it was either 5 or 7 cylinder pistol. They made the engines even. It was an unusual thing. Normally, companies did not build their own engines. It was just too much machining, too much technical knowledge to build an engine, also the airframe. They built that in hopes of getting a military contract.
Oh, I see.
As a trainer. And of course, sometimes dreams just don't
come
true.
Out. Yes.
I don't think it failed because it wasn't a good little airplane. Who knows? Took the contract that they didn't get. As I understand it, this was a little bit more. Interesting, before I was old enough to be involved.
Yes. Right. Now you say the peak was around 1,800 people employed there during the war.
During the war years.
What would, before the war, what would be the complement or what would be the number of workers?
Oh, I would say 500. I think we were up around 500 employees. Producing how many days? 4 times a day. We had things worked down.
Yes.
Real nice.
Now, how much real skill? Many of these workers just sort of piecework, assembly line, or did they have to have a skill?
Piecework. This is one thing that never done in an airplane factory in my days, because everything had to be was rigidly inspected. It had to be just right. And there was quality first, and then speed would come with practice, but you're going to learn to do it right first. You don't want a whole lot of bad parts.
Yeah.
And there was no piecework. It was all, there was tooling, of course, stuff. Jigs, so that you would get uniform parts. Back when I started in the sheet metal department, we would take pieces of steel, maybe 5 or 6, and clamp them together and have one that was already cut out like for a fitting from a fuselage. And we would hacksaw and file those out, maybe 5 or 6 at a time. And until we got dies made, I had made many a part with a hacksaw and file. I think this is one thing about our situation industry-wise today, where the opportunity doesn't exist for the individual. But back in those days, if you could afford a hacksaw and a file, and you could weld and you had the engineering ability, you could build an airplane. I mean, you could be in competition with the next man. But not so today. If you don't have $4 million invested in some tape-controlled machines and big hydro presses and so forth, forget it. It's out of your realm of possibility. Don't even dream about it because you're fooling yourself.
I suppose this would have come in itself, but the war, the pressure to produce during the war made a lot of that come much faster, didn't it?
Oh, definitely, yes. In 1941, in November the 10th, we delivered the first 10 trial order of military planes to Wright Field. I had a record in my logbook. I came down there. It was designated the Y-57, which was a designation of an experimental aircraft for the military. They designated it. Y-O, I think Y-O was a general experimental designation for a military aircraft. This was a Y-57. Took 3 hours of flight from here to I remember Dick DePue led the flight, and then we flew in an echelon, one just a little higher than the other, buzzing along at about 75, 80 miles an hour, I suppose, flying over there. That was my first entry in a logbook of flying a military airplane. Of course, I had several thousand hours during the war. I had a flight instructor and another military. And I had the great fortune to be a test pilot on one of the very, what was my own airplane, Carl Elkins, who was then domestic sales manager. And I flew it to Fort Knox, Godman Field there. And I had, this was a 1939 model. I think I was the first man that ever bought, that worked there, ever bought a new airplane.
Hmm.
And all at least I recognized back then that a company or an industry cannot be successful if its employees can't buy what it produces.
That's right, yes.
I saw its shortcoming, and it's never changed after 30 years. But this airplane, I had a large speaker built in it. I would fly over a city, and I would do aerial advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember how many watts of power I had, but I know it was strictly you had to wear a parachute to become the electrical equipment.
Oh, yes.
And I had wind, engines didn't have generators on them, so I had a generator out mounted out on the strut with a propeller on it to generate electricity to operate this. I had a mic that hung on my breast. I tried a throat mic that the military used, but the quality was so bad. But I took that airplane to Godman Field and worked with the Tank Corps. And this was the very first starter plane idea. The radios were of poor quality. And I was, there's only two airplanes in America, to my knowledge, that had speakers in them. The Pure Oil Company had a large system and a big blanket that they used for advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I got the idea. I put it in a smaller airplane and sold advertising time and worked the cities around in this area, far down in Miami, Florida.
Hmm.
But the idea was we would fly up ahead, and if there was a bridge out, we would fly back and tell the commander of the tank corps, or tank crew, a bunch of was in tanks, well, go around this way because this bridge is out. But we couldn't make the fellows hear all the noise of the tanks. But it was the first attempt.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And I was fortunate enough to have been a part of it.
Yeah. Of course, I think so many people today even forget. I remember how astounded I was when I got to England and I heard so much about the Spitfires. Well, I actually saw one, and I thought, that little thing, you know, is what Churchill was talking about. But it performed. It did. But when you saw it, it looked like just a little insignificant thing.
Well, you know, back in 1937, I believe, or 37, 38, the Taylor Craft Aussie plant was set up in England. And the Taylor Craft was built in England under license to the parent company there. Our chief engineer, Ray Carlson, went over there for a while.
I see.
And they made copies of all the drawings and so forth. And the Telegraph Office, Aussie, played a very important role as a spotter plane for the Royal Air Force, which is basically nothing but a telegraph aircraft.
Right.
Oh, yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
Well, you talked about morale with the group there. Did that continue when you had 1,800, or when you had the top number on?
Yes, because not in a different way. In a different way, the morale was bolstered by the necessity to win a war and to help your friends that were over there fighting this war. It was a different. Entirely different. The morale in 1937, 36 and 37, was, I think, the fact that a man could work on a machine that was a sophisticated machine at that time and see it fly. And the test pilots had a little habit. Whenever they had a plane ready to test, they would be walking down through the plant with their parachute. And the sort of rule, they'd pick out somebody out of the plant and say, come on, we're going to test this airplane.
Uh-huh.
You never knew when you're going to have to ride it. And we had a little joke that was on some little minor thing. We'd say, well, at 10,000 feet and in a blinding snowstorm, who's going to see it?
Yeah. Until you had to take a ride.
Yeah, that's right. really a wonderful place to work.
Mm-hmm.
A wonderful opportunity to learn, and associate with the breed talented engineers. Engineers are really making history. Just every opportunity in the world. And I think that I can look back over the years with associates
mm-hmm.
that worked there that has all profited by their experiences mm-hmm. there. Met with other large, many of them went over to Goodyear Aerospace.
Oh, yes.
Went over there.
Now, you said you flew a plane to Cuba. Did you fly any others to Mexico, Central America?
I sent them down.
I see.
In charge of getting them there.
I see.
I'm so involved in the operation.
Right.
Getting larger and so forth. And I sent them down. Time to get out and go on the trips myself.
Sure. Much as you would have enjoyed that.
Yes, very much.
Right.
In fact, it broke my heart to
see
it.
Oh, yeah.
Stay there. But I had other things, paperwork and so forth to do.
I suppose when you drive home, you'll think of some anecdote, but right off the cuff, can you think of something amusing, anecdotal in connection with the Taylor craft? You talked about this joke that went around 10,000 feet in a blinding snowstorm. Were there any others of this nature, or were there any pranks, or could they afford to indulge in that?
A lot of incidents, let's say, but I just can't recall. I do remember one night, I don't know whether they fit into the category you're looking for or not, but Mr. Hart, who's the president of the company, officers right next to mine, and said, Duke, Dick King and I, who was assistant to the president, has to catch a flight out of Columbus, Ohio, to Washington. And he said, Paul Dietz, which was one of our test pilots, is going to fly me down, one of us, and you fly one of the other ones down. And it was about dark then, I guess. We were like in the working in the office. And so Paul, he only had two place airplanes.
Yeah.
He had two people to go. He took two airplanes, unless neither one of them could fly. Wow. So Paul flew one down, I flew one down. Paul landed over at Thornton Field. The airlines operated in and out of Port Columbus. However, Curtis Wright was building a Navy plane there, and it was closed to general civil aviation. Well, I figured, we're prime contractors for the military effort. Here I have a company executive catching an airliner to go to Washington. This isn't pleasure flying. This is a professional flight. I'm going to land at Port Columbus. So I did it. They didn't say anything that night. Jeep come out, military Jeep come out. Said, follow me, and just took me to a tie-down area, tied down. I wasn't going to fly back that night. We stayed in the hotel. The next morning I went out, they said, no, this new year flight's really a civilian flight. We're not a military operation. We had military flights up, and I didn't put them flying. He said, the ministry was closed to civil aviation. I said, I told him the circumstances. Mm-hmm. He was giving me a pretty hard time. Finally, he gave me permission to take off. So in taxiing out, there was a P-38 Lightning right in front of me. And whenever you go out to the end of the runway or a taxi strip, they're supposed to turn 45 degrees and blow the dust back across the field, not back on the airplane behind them. This is only common courtesy and also military safety rule. But I'm quite sure that the boy, we had the grace to give the boy a dust and all.
Oh, yeah.
He tested those two big owls and engines developing, about 1,200 horsepower apiece. He had over 2,000 horsepower. And I sit there and I have a little tail down the back. I actually raise up about 3 feet off the ground and I let it go backwards. I knew I couldn't turn away from it because he'd roll me across the field like a tiger. And I never sat back with a man to check his mags any longer. But I know the boys in the tower was having a great time.
I bet they said, he won't land here again. Well, I'm Sure. Well, that you can laugh when you look back on it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure at that time.
But I took it as a joke, too.
Right.
I knew how to motivate.
Sure.
I've been flying with him for a couple of years. While I was a civilian, but I was under contract.
Sure.
To teach for the Army.
Where were you based?
I instructed at Fort Morgan, Colorado. I instructed at Ryder Academy in Arizona at Hickenburg. I was a flight instructor at Ballinger Field and Bruce Field in Ballinger, Texas. And I flew basic training. That's where we give the boys their formation, instrument, and night flying. It was then War Eagle Field. It's now Edwards Air Force Base.
Oh.
I just left there. The end of the war was coming. It wasn't over yet. But they saw it coming. They knew it was going to end. And they always had pilots in training to be instructors.
Mm-hmm.
And if some of those that were instructors didn't leave, they would have to go. And I thought, well, I can recall, I had a brother who was a P-51 fighter pilot. And one night we were flying to the All-American Show at 9 in 1939. And Swineford and I were together with the man I spoke of.
Yes.
And we got caught over Valdosta, Georgia at night with no airport with any lights. And we had to make an emergency landing in a turnip patch. And we were sitting around, and I think Lee Sherrick must have been in on that much, but we were sitting around a hotel talking. Three planes that was Royal Lines from Royal Lines saved all of our skins because he had talked to Charlie Lindbergh, your friend Charlie Lindbergh, and Charlie Lindbergh flew the airmail and a night line. He said, anytime you get into trouble at night, pick a plowed field because the grass is dark.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in areas where it's sandy, a plowed field will be lighter in color. And Roy took this plowed turnip patch. And he went in and landed first, and I'm not ashamed of admit it. I went in second.
Uh-huh.
Another airplane came in the third time. But there was one plane crashed in the upset. Nobody was hurt. I lost an airplane.
Yeah.
But sitting around talking, and Lee Sherrick said, it's no good for two brothers to fly. One of them was he killed. And I was climbing down off of the wing of a B-213 Baltic at War Eagle Field. My brother was flying combat out of it. And I thought of that. And then we'd been told a couple days before about the situation. And I thought, I'm going to give somebody else a chance. And I'm not going to shove this luck, this thing.
Yeah.
I think pilots might have been a little bit superstitious. A little bit. I'm not going to shove this thing on two brothers flying, but he was killed.
Is that right?
Yeah, so he was still in one of his last missions in the end of the night. Shot down in the gym.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't be any good.
Yeah. Can you recall at the plant, of course, you had to have utmost safety precautions, especially with the dope part, that operation, were there any bad accidents?
The dope room blew up on the average once a year.
Yeah.
And Mr. Woods, who was the postmaster at Lionville, lost his son in one of the dope room fires. Johnny Hell, who was a well-known trainer in the fire department, his son was chief, or his father was chief Hell.
Yes.
Johnny was burnt very bad in one of the fires.
Now this, when you say the dope room, this was used to...
This was cellulose nitrate. This is gunpowder, is what it was. Gunpowder is made from cellulose.
Yes.
From cotton and wool. And the dope that we use to put on the fabric to shrink it, it was fast. It's a lacquer.
Mm-hmm.
If the lacquer's in the same family, it's quite explosive. And I can remember one more, and in the new dope room, we only had one fire to my knowledge. But a man brought a drum, a 55-gallon drum of dope in on a push cart, and he set it down, and when the steel drum hit the floor, set off a spark in there. I saw the fire doors come open. I was working right outside of in the final assembly, teaching some girls how to make some new parts. And my heaven, there was just a sheet of flame. I mean, it's so fast that the explosion. Now they had in that dope room, the west wall was all glass. So in case of an explosion, it just blew glass out. Mm-hmm. The last dope room we had lost, it had exploded. It was a wood frame building, and they just lifted the roof up, blew the sides out. The roof set very neat, right back down on the foundation. The sides all went out. The very little fire, there was some, of course, exploded.
Sure.
There was no continuing fire. It was just actually basically an explosion.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, the dope room gave us problems in that respect. Then it was a bad place to work. It would make you intoxicated.
Mm-hmm. Inhale those fumes.
Inhale the vapor of the spray, you see. They kept milk in a box outside the dope room. And the man, especially the spray painters, would come out after, I don't know, just what the end of it was. One department I never worked in was the dope room. I worked in most all the departments in the factory. But I never did work in the dope room. Well, I don't work in the machine shop. But we come out, and you drink a lot of milk. This would coat your stomach. It doesn't help this place.
Right. What about your testing, the test pilots? They test these planes. Did you have any incidents there?
Well, the late Al Barber, bless his heart, passed away just about a year ago. A great person and a wonderful friend. Al was one of the old test pilots that tested with probably hundreds and hundreds of airplanes. We never lost an airplane in the test flight. But one day the boys hooked the aileron cables up backwards.
Uh-huh.
And of course we called him Amy. And Amy got it off on a roll. He was too far along to cut power and get it back in the field again. It was good out. You know, the last thing the pilot wants to do is make a turn back in the field. This is what they call a suicide turn.
Mm-hmm.
But so he had to go on in and fly. But he landed it in the field over south. In fact, he wouldn't even bring it back in the field. But I know, even though it's hooked up.